Today's Teisho will be on Yunyan's Great Compassion, which is case 54 in the Book of Serenity. Introduction. Crystal clear on all sides, open and unobstructed in all directions, emanating light and making the earth tremble in all places, subtly exercising spiritual powers at all times. Tell me, how is this manifested? Case. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, what does the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Dao Wu said, it's like someone reaching back for the pillow at night. Yunyan said, I understand. Dao Wu said, how do you understand? Yunyan said, all over the body, his hands and eyes. Dao Wu said, you said a lot there, but you got only 80%. Yunyan said, what about you, elder brother? Throughout the body, his hands and eyes. Verse. One whole emptiness pervading, crystal clear on all sides, formlessly, selflessly, spring enters the pipes. Unstopped, unhindered, the moon traverses the sky. Pure jewel eyes, arms of virtues, all over the body. How does it compare to throughout the body being it? The present hands and eyes reveal the whole works. The great function works in all ways. What is taboo? I want to thank you all for coming here on this beautiful September morning and practicing the way. I hope you had a wonderful sit this morning. Let me just go through the case one more time. Two deeply enlightened Chan Zen practitioners are having an exchange with one another. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, what does the great Bodhisattva of Compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Now, sometimes you have probably seen statues of Guanyin or Kanon or Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. And often that figure is represented as a woman holding a vase and tipping the vase over, and this is like compassion spilling out across the world. But sometimes Guanyin or Kanon is represented as having many arms. Perhaps you've seen a representation of Guanyin in that way. Usually there's a figure of a person, and then where there would be two arms, there's many arms. There's like a circle of arms, and sometimes the arms are the hands on the arms are holding different sorts of objects that might be helpful to people. So one hand might have a scroll, one hand might have something else, a pen. One hand might have a tool, one hand might have some grain, and like stalks of wheat. So this is a standard representation of Guanyin as a being who manifests compassion through activity. So Guanyin is sometimes shown with not really a thousand hands, but a representation of a thousand arms and hands with different things that can be helpful to people. And the idea is that bodhisattvas are constantly aware of difficulties faced by other people and are constantly trying to help other people So that's the core image in this koan. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Now this is a Zen question. Sometimes Zen masters will ask their students a question which seems like an ordinary question. So a Zen master might ask a monk who's come to his monastery, where do you come from? And the question is looks like an innocent question, but it's really an attempt to assess the monk's state of mind. So if you go to a Zen center and the teacher says, where do you come from? And you say, from New Jersey, okay, that's actually not a bad answer. See, that's not a bad answer. I think a worse answer would be something like to say, from oneness, is it? Instead of, you know, from all oneness I come from, you know, or I come from the emptiness, you know. Those would be actually inferior answers. A better answer would be, I come from New Jersey. You know, just not straining to be special, stating matter-of-factly what's the case. And sometimes it's very hard for people to just be in reality. In fact, it's generally hard for people to be in reality. So a beginner might say, I come from the source. See, all is one. You know, and a more advanced practitioner might say, I come from New Jersey. So. But even more advanced practitioner would try to manifest awakened mind. If that person has had some experiences of awakened mind, that person would try to manifest awakened mind in some way. And the answer might involve, say, clapping hands or being silent. The person would be in deep samadhi and would respond from deep samadhi, deep concentration. So when somebody asked Master Zhaozhu, does a dog have Buddha nature, Zhaozhu could have said, yes, everything has Buddha nature. But instead he said, ooh. See, this means this is manifesting awakened mind, not describing awakened mind. So if a teacher, you go to a Zen center and the teacher says, where do you come from? And you say, oneness. See, that's actually a philosophical answer, right? That's actually a philosophical answer. It's actually very theoretical and very abstract intellectual answer. It shows that you're still experiencing your problems, you're still approaching your problems using your discriminating intellect. So when you encounter a question, a real question, where do you come from? Immediately your discriminating intellect arises and tries to resolve the issue philosophically. So this is like ordinary consciousness. As I say, a little more advanced practitioner would not be drawn into that game, and he might not exactly have had too many encounters with awakened awareness, but would still know enough not to fall into that trap and say, oh, listen, I've wasted so many years of my life trying to think through things with a discriminating mind. You're not going to sucker me into that. So look, I come from New Jersey. You know, I come from... And the teacher would say, okay, that's not bad. At least you're not living in the realm of pure illusion. See. But more advanced practitioner would try to manifest in some way, to point directly to the source, to awareness at this moment. And that could involve a shout, could involve slapping the teacher. Not really. Although I hope you'll never, But if you must, you must, and just not too hard. But it could involve, putting your shoes on your head and walking out the door, as Zhaozhu does in another koan. So this is a Zen encounter. it's a teacher or the lead person, Yunyan, is testing Dao Wu's insight, the level of his mind. And so he has a question. What does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Now, if Dao Wu had said, oh, don't you see? These hands are representations of compassion in action. Each of these represents a different way of helping people, see? So the grain means feeding people, see? The scroll means teaching people, helping them to read and write, you know? So that would be ordinary mind, right? That if a person gave that kind of answer, it would be okay, but it wouldn't show a deeper consciousness, deeper awareness, see? So Dao Wu is also deeply awake. So this is like an exchange between two people who are both quite accomplished, have spent many years in awakened mind. Now, as I've said many times, it is never accurate to say that a certain person is enlightened. It's never the case that a person is enlightened. Even though I even say that sometimes, I'll say, oh yes, he's deeply enlightened. What I should really say is that person has spent a long time in enlightened mind. That's more accurate. So when you come to sit, and sometimes you sit on the cushion and not much happens, but every once in a while you begin to feel your tension dropping away, and you begin to feel this happiness, this joy, and you begin to feel this sense of connectedness to things, and you might just feel just wonderful for no particular reason. You're not thinking anymore. You're not trying to solve your problems by thinking them through. You're just in the moment, see? Just in the moment. And sometimes if you're sitting near a window where the window's open, you might hear the crickets. And it just feels like the crickets are coming out of your own body. Or you hear a bird, and it just feels like the bird sound is coming out of yourself. See, this is Buddha. This is enlightened mind. So it's not really the case. Many people think you live many years in complete ignorance and then boom, you have a great awakening experience and then you're an enlightened person. It's not like that at all. What happens is that we begin to spend more and more time in prajna paramita, in awakened mind. And we sit on the cushion. Many times you just don't connect with the universe that well. That's just the fact. But every once in a while, you sit down on the cushion and boom, you know, you have that connection. Maybe a little tiny bit, maybe for a few seconds, or maybe for like 20 minutes, you know, just a pure happiness, pure bliss. But either way, it's Buddha. That's really it. You know, so don't ever think to yourself, oh my gosh, I've been practicing all these years and no enlightenment. You know, it's not so. Every time you sit on the cushion, you have that kind of experience that you're tasting enlightened mind. That's the truth. And so if you take Zen seriously, you build your life around those moments. See, you make room for practice in your life, and then those moments begin to happen more and more. And that's the Zen life, that's the Chan life, is to make a space for that in your life. Make that, for me personally, that's like the core of my life. That's, I live to do that. That's my center of my life. It doesn't have to be the center of your life, but it does have to be, you know, very important. You have to make time and space for that. And then if you spend a lot of time there, it begins to change you. It really begins to change you. You know, I say this to beginners when they come to sit. Now, all the time we're creating our minds. You know, you are what you think. You are as you think. That's what the Buddha taught. You know, we often think the self is somewhere over here and what we think is over here, or our experience is here and our self is somewhere else. But the world you construct with your mind is yourself, right? And so, you know, when you turn on TV, and you're watching violent acts of violent revenge or hatred, you might even find yourself identifying with the Punisher. This is quite common. Many movies work this way. You know, a person is identified as the bad guy, and we're shown, you know, the movie, usually Hollywood movies are not very subtle. Perhaps you've noticed that. So they always show, this is the bad guy, and he does something really bad, right? So you hate him. And then the good guy is always, like, totally good, right? Or he has a few minor flaws, and that makes him cute. But generally speaking, totally good, totally bad, right? And then the bad guy is destroyed by the good guy. And there's this tremendous sense of satisfaction, like, oh, blow him away. You know? Now, this is really very common in movies, and it's very unhealthy. It's really like anti-Buddhism. It's anti-chan. Because it's creating anxiety, hatred, aggressiveness, and distance between yourself and the world. So you know, a lot of our culture does this to us. So, you know, you might be watching TV and there's a commercial. And basically, maybe they're selling like the Whopper, like a gigantic hamburger. You know. Now, probably eating hamburgers isn't very good for you anyway. But what's not so good about the commercial is that it's saying, look, don't be happy in the present moment. Want something that's not here now. You should want something that's not here now. In fact, you should rush out and go get a Whopper. Right? So it's kind of like a training in being unhappy and being craving something in the future. So this goes on all the time. This goes on all the time. So it's very important to make space in your life to have those encounters with enlightened mind. It's like medicine for your mind and heart and body. So you sit on the cushion, and you sit on the cushion, and every once in a while you hit it, and you're there, and you have real joy. You don't need a Whopper, you know. You don't have to blow anybody away with your machine gun, you know. Just present in the moment, and it's pure joy. It's like heaven itself. See, that is enlightenment. So it's not so much that we're trying to achieve enlightenment. We need to spend some time with enlightenment. See, it's like being in love. You know, if you fall in love, you want to be with the person you love. Well, if you fall in love with enlightenment, you want to spend some time with them. You need to make a few dates with enlightenment. Right? You know, and spend some time, and then you know life just gets better and better. Because we realize, you know, that ordinary consciousness is quite confused, whereas this other way of life is really beautiful. I would say incomparably beautiful and wonderful. So anyway, no such thing as an enlightened person. There's a person who spends a lot of time in enlightened mind. So Daowu is somebody who spent a lot of time in enlightened mind. So when Yunyan says, what does the great Bodhisattva of compassion do with all those hands? Daowu says, it's like someone reaching back for the pillow at night. See, it's like someone, this is really interesting. Let me just digress just a little bit to get to this second part of the koan. One person in our group, I don't think this person will mind, approached me and said, is it possible for me to think the thoughts of another person? In other words, sometimes on the cushion I feel like I'm receiving thoughts from other people. Is this a telepathy? Is this happening to me on the cushion? And, you know, that's a really interesting question. And not a silly question at all. And the person said, I really do feel like I'm receiving thoughts from other people when I'm not just sitting on the cushion, but when I'm off the cushion. And is this what's happening? And I was trying to think about, this is really interesting, right? really interesting issue. One way to decide if you can send thoughts is to come to Sesshin. Come to Sesshin. Because, you know, it's day two of Sesshin, and you're sitting there thinking, please ring the bell. And you can try to send me a mental message. Ring the bell. Ring the bell. Please ring the bell. You know. And it could be I'm receiving your message and I'm just ignoring it. Right? I'm receiving the mental message. But it could, but you know, the truth is I'm not getting the message. If people could communicate telepathically with one another after doing lots of meditation, we wouldn't have any koans, right? Because everyone would just be, it would be like this. Yunyan sat next to Dawu. Then Dawu got up and left, right? A monk sat next to Joshu. Joshu got up and left, right? We don't know what they said. I myself at one time believed that people, if they sat long enough, probably could communicate telepathically. Sometimes it may feel like you are receiving the thoughts of other people. This is very similar, let me say, to another kind of, something's happening on the cushion. If you get that feeling like you're getting thoughts from other people, something is happening to you that's real, but I would say it's being misinterpreted. And that's also true in another example. You know, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but sometimes when people enter deep samadhi, they feel like their hands or their face are disappearing. For me, that's how I usually enter deep samadhi. When I begin to feel like I'm literally just disappearing, my body starts to disappear on the cushion, and it starts with my face and my hands go away. And then I just feel like everything's draining out of me, and then I'm sort of gone, except for just vague body sensations. My teacher, Genki Roshi, my sifu, used to say he felt like incense. The top of his head would start to disappear, and it would just drop through down his spine, and he'd be gone. Some people experience samadhi in a different way. They feel like they're floating off the cushion. Now, there are actually traditions of meditation where people are taught that they do float, they do levitate, right? And I would say, somewhat absurdly, they try to produce photographs of people levitating. And it looks like they're bouncing up and down on their cushion really hard. Maybe they are levitating, but so far I've met some very people who have spent a lot of time in enlightened mind. Even the Dalai Lama doesn't levitate, right? When he wants to travel, he uses a car, which is an important point. So the thing is, it feels like your body is disappearing, but if they took a photograph, or if somebody was looking at you across the Zen hall, you'd be right there. So it's a mistaken interpretation to think that you're actually levitating. You're not. You're not flying. It just feels like you're flying. Okay. Something's happening to you, though, that's real. You're entering deep samadhi, and the way you experience body sensations is radically changing. See, your mind is being transformed by sitting practice, and your body is, you're re-experiencing your body like a baby again. You're re-experiencing your body in a fresh way, and it feels very strange and different. And this is like a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to undo so much negative karma that shapes our bodies. Even our bodies are distorted by karma, by negative karma. We learn how to distribute energy in the body in certain ways that create blockages. And basically, these go with us all our lives. So you will meet people who develop a lot of tension in their shoulders, for example. Now, sometimes if you have tension in your shoulders, it's because your cushion isn't high enough and you need to stick a towel under there and raise your tension goes away. So that's just a problem with the design of the cushion. Feel free to stick a towel under there. But if you have the towel and you still build up a lot of tension in your shoulders when you sit, that might be a karmic product of your karma. So people develop blockages. They develop rigidity in their body. You know, part of yoga is physically undoing that, those rigidities which are created by life, partly by life experiences. So when we sit on the cushion and we enter deep samadhi, it's like we're recreating our physical body. We're cleansing it of its blockages and its distortions. And we're learning how to experience the body in a different way. This is really true. And I have friends who are scientists who are quite interested in meditation, and they send me articles occasionally about how meditation really does change the way your brain processes body sensation, and it changes your endocrine system, and so on. So quite real changes are happening, but you're not actually disappearing on the cushion. Well, this is also true with your psychology. You know, so if you spend a lot of time in enlightened mind, it changes your psychology just as it changes your body. So when you are out in the world dealing with other people, you begin to have a different relationship, not only with the world, but with other human beings. You know, I mentioned earlier that when you sit on the cushion and you're in samadhi and you hear a bird, it might sound like that sound is coming right out of your own heart. The other morning I was sitting and listening to crickets. At my house there's just crickets everywhere. They're in the house, they're on the walls. I don't know how they get in. I'm happy to have them. I really love these crickets. And they're just crazy, you know. And I was sitting the other morning and I was just listening to them, and it was just like everywhere, crickets, crickets, crickets. And I've just felt like I'm a cricket, you know. I just felt wonderful about these crickets. That's deep samadhi. And when you're in deep samadhi, the sense of separation between yourself and the world disappears. And when that sense of separation between yourself and the world disappears, that's what when we say prajna paramita, see, that's wisdom. That means prajna is wisdom, and paramita means the other shore, the other side. See, now you could interpret this as the wisdom of the other shore. This is the Buddha said, my teaching is like a raft to get you from one side of the river to the other side of the river. So the other shore, the one shore is self-centered life. Selfish, fearful, angry, aggressive. Okay. When we watch the breath and we enter samadhi and we practice ushin, we begin to experience the world as part of ourselves and ourselves as part of the world. That's unity. Small self disappears and there's this connectedness with everything. And that's the other shore that Lord Buddha talked about, the paramita, other shore. So when the sense of separation from the world disappears, that's wisdom. That's Buddhist wisdom, see. It's not ideas. It's not an insight. All is one, all is two, all is three. See, those are just ideas. It's the experience of connection or the freedom from the illusion of separation. Because everything really is one. Everything, but saying so is not the same thing as experiencing it. So when you sit on the cushion and you experience that oneness, it's just a wonderful thing. It's heaven. That's there is no other heaven. That's heaven. I don't see how anyone could ask for anything more. It's just totally wonderful. And then you get off the cushion and you go to your job and you begin to feel like you're interacting with people in a different way, because you are. See, normally we're so fearful, we're so frightened. Years of aggression and ridicule and so on make us, we go, it's like we walk around in our lives with heavy armor on. You've maybe seen those medieval knights, right, with their European soldiers used to wear pieces of steel over their bodies to protect them from blows, right, from other swords and arrows. So after a while, they could hardly walk. In fact, there was a famous German emperor who was leading an army, and he fell off his horse into the water, and he drowned because his armor was so heavy, it sank right to the bottom. You know, so we do the same thing in our lives. We psychologically armor ourselves, you know, so that we're constantly waiting for other people to hurt us or to offend us. And you know, it happens to us as we grow up that, you know, we get injured by other people. You know, maybe your experience was different, but in my school there always seemed to be a bully, you know, somebody who would beat all the other kids up. And also, you know, people, little kids make fun of other little kids. You know, if you don't necessarily fit their idea of what a little kid should be, if you're too thin or too heavy, or you're too tall or you're too short, if your nose is too big or too little, if your ears are too long or too whatever, you generally get ridiculed, you know. And so after a while, you become very careful about yourself, yeah? And millions of experiences of fear and embarrassment that create armor around ourselves. So normally, you know, on the job, we're very armored. It's like we're very careful, very fearful. And we don't think about it, because it's like if you lived in armor all your life, you wouldn't even think about it, right? It just would seem like natural, your natural state. So you know, we monitor our behavior all the time. We monitor our appearance all the time. We're constantly second-guessing ourselves in our interactions with other people. And of course, in a certain way, we have to do that sometime, right? Because everybody else is not wonderful and not kind. Everybody else doesn't love us. You know, some people actually want to hurt us. That's the truth. And some people don't want to hurt us, but they do by accident. So our caution is not irrational, but it's very crippling, right? And so if you do zazen, if you sit on the cushion and you enter wuxin and or muxin, and you encounter enlightened mind, you become a little more willing to take some risks in your human experiences. So you might actually feel, in the presence of other people, more trusting and more open. And that feeling of openness can be quite dramatic, you know, it can be quite impressive. And I think in that state, it would be very easy to imagine that you're reading other people's minds or that they're reading your mind, because there's this feeling of connection or transparency all around you. See, I think that would be very easy to see happening. The truth is that studies done of people who meditate for a long time. They've done studies of the Dalai Lama and also a number of other meditators. And there are measures, psychological ways of measuring people's powers of empathy, how sensitive they are to the emotions of other people and the feelings of other people. And the Dalai Lama has scored, you know, very, very high on these tests of empathy. And there was somebody in the test, an American monk in the Tibetan tradition, who scored even higher than the Dalai Lama in these psychological tests of empathy. But if you do meditation for a while, it's not surprising that people who meditate would do well, because this openness, this sense of openness, happens naturally if you just spend some time with awakened mind. You have some dates with awakened mind. And if you go steady with awakened mind and you marry awakened mind, you know, you eventually have like really, you begin to experience other people's happiness as your happiness and other people's suffering as your suffering. And that line between yourself and the world tends to drop away. And so it's very much like telepathy, yes? So, you know, somebody might come in and they don't say, I'm unhappy, but, you know, maybe they're sending you cues, right? Their behavior is a certain way, and you say, oh, what's wrong? And they say, oh, how did you know? You know, well, it's not telepathy, it's just sensitivity, right? You know, but it's real, not an illusion. It's empirically measurable, right? And it's a wonderful thing, the deepening sensitivity. Normally, people aren't very sensitive because they're fearful and angry. The other day, I was on my way to class. Friday was just a beautiful morning. I got up and I sat, and then I took a shower and was going to teach my class, which is at 9:50. And I left the house a little late because I sat on the cushion a little too long. It was just a little too nice. So I make a promise to myself, I never leave the house later than 9 o'clock because there could be traffic, you know, whatever. And I left a little late, so I was in a hurry, and I was close to Stelton Avenue. And there was a car ahead of me and in the street, and the street at that point branches off into two lanes. It's a one-lane road, and it becomes two lanes. And to the right was a ShopRite supermarket. So there was a car ahead of me, and it was on the left side of the road. And I tried to squeeze past on the right, past that car. I was starting to squeeze past. And the person in the car pulled sharply over to the right and cut me off, and then kept going toward the ShopRite. And I was going, so I almost had an accident. And as I was driving forward, the person flicked me the bird. Because I have no idea what that's all about, right? You know, I have no idea, right? So, you know, these experiences happen all the time. And they make us, you know, many people are fearful and angry, right? It's a vicious circle if we let it bother us, right? But if you spend some time with enlightened mind, you begin to not care about stuff like that. You know, it's just it's sad, a little sad, and it's a little funny, right? You know, it's mostly just ridiculous, right? And the guy was a teenager, right? Which says it all, right? You know, I have no idea, you know, what his problems are. And but the thing is, you know, you do have when you begin to take a risk, you know, when you begin to take a risk, people can behave in ways that could injure you. You know, that can happen. It's not like a perfect world, you know. So, you know, you could open up and somebody could hurt you. And then you have to decide, well, maybe I shouldn't open up. You know, maybe I shouldn't be so open with people. Maybe I should be more careful. And it's a difficult negotiation, because with some people you do indeed have to be careful. But on the other hand, openness has many rewards, you know. And so sometimes if people hurt you, you just get back on the cushion and you sit and you sit, and you realize, oh, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to be hurt by this. I'm not going to let this close me up, right? So this is really like the Chan way to live, the Zen way to live. It's like, oh, you know, he flicked me the bird. I'll get over it. You know, it's not or whatever. You know, so it could be something serious. You know, somebody you care. You know, a sister. Somebody says something that hurts your feelings. You know, somebody you care about. Right? That happens to us all the time. But you sit on the cushion and you enter a mu xin and enter that beautiful enlightened mind, and you you just realize, oh, this is, I'm not going to let this, I'm not going to let this spoil my beautiful life, right? This is a, and anyway, people who live this way have a different relationship to the world, right? And you know, basically, one way to go around, well, if you begin to experience the joy of other people as your joy, and their suffering as their suffering is your suffering, see, you know, you do try to help people, just automatically. It's kind of what you do. It's sort of a like automatic response. You want people to be happier rather than sadder, because actually, it's like we are all sharing one life. See, so it's not like, well, your happiness is your happiness, my it's all one life. You know, the more you sit, the more it all becomes one life. So it's like your unhappiness really is my unhappiness. So I ought to try to help you, you know, because actually, if I can help you get rid of your unhappiness, I'm going to be happy too, because your happiness is my happiness. So we're really not separate, really not. That's really an illusion. Dao Wu understands this, you know. Guan Yin's helping hands, Guan Yin uses her hands without thinking about it. She's just, it's like reaching back for the pillow at night. It's like something you don't even think about. Automatically, you're helping other people. It's like automatic. You don't say, oh, I must help, or aren't I a good boy to help other people? It's just like adjusting the pillow so your head is more comfortable. See, everybody is your head. Everybody's pillow is your pillow. So you're trying to help because you're helping yourself. Sounds a little selfish, but there's no separation on a deeper level. The thing is, there's still no telepathy. This is very important because we aren't all one on the level of thoughts. Isn't that interesting? Thinking it automatically creates a distance between ourselves and other people, and ourselves and the world. Thinking is like the echo of experience. It's like an echo of it's memory's echo of experience. Yeah? And it's like a picture of the past that we can impose on the present. This is sort of what thinking is all about. So thinking creates a kind of distance between ourselves and the world. You know, we usually experience, if you look at the moment as it unfolds, if you meditate for, say, 10 years, it will be rather obvious to you that we have experiences in little waves. So there's pure experience, pure moment. And then there's a thought arises, which is immediately separating us from the moment. And then emotion follows that, and then experience. Then thought, then emotion, just as like waves. And it's a process that can't be stopped. It's the way consciousness works. But the thing is, separates us. So on the level of thought, we're not the same. We're separate. That's the level of reality which we're different. So actually, it's not possible for us to become one by sharing thoughts. You know, I'm a teacher of English, and one of the most interesting things is you can bring in a little story or a little article, maybe a newspaper article, and you can give it to 20 people, and they all come away with a different understanding of it. They'll all come up with something different. See, they'll all analyze it and all say something different. They won't even understand it the same way. So even words, you know, if I give you five words, you'll understand it your way, she'll understand it her way. On this level, we're all separate. So you know, really and truly, telepathy is not possible, right? Because language is what separates us from immediate experience of reality. Now it is true, language circulates, so you can share words, right, in a certain sense. Words circulate. You didn't invent the English language, it just circulates. Like money. ideas are just like money. They just float around and people pick them up and drop them or trade them in for other ideas. But how you experience them is actually always different from everybody else's experience, in my opinion. So we're not the same on the level of ideas. We're different. In fact, ideas create the difference. Thinking creates the difference. But on the level of wuxing, deeper, see, we have a little mind that thinks in words and images and concepts and so on. And that's a little mind, and we're all different on the level of the little mind. But we have a deeper mind. The little mind is like the tiny little tip of a big mind, and this giant mind, and this mind doesn't think. See, so on the level of wuxing, on the level of great emptiness, we're all the same. And don't be deceived, great emptiness is alive, not dead. See, we tend to think that the world of ideas and concepts is real, and then when we look in our minds and we see this blankness, we just think, oh, that's just a blankness, that's just dead, that's nothing. But nothingness is just a word to describe something that can't be described with words. It's not dead, it's totally alive. See, the truth is, it's the other way around. Concepts are actually quite dead, I would say. And we animate them. We bring them to life with our energy. But they're not alive in themselves. And they actually take the energy out of something after a while. But we have this deeper mind. When we look in our, when we're doing meditation, and you look at your mind, sooner or later you notice that there's this blankness or darkness. There are these moments where the mind is empty and dark. And this is not dead. This is not a dead emptiness. This is like, this is the door into a big mind. And it's life itself, life itself. So if you live the Zen life, you spend a lot of time at that place. And you begin to experience this tremendous sense of connection. Everything, every life is your life. You're on the, so everything comes from the same source, the same root. Yeah. So that's kind of what this koan is all about. My helping you is just like my adjusting my own pillow. We're one life. Your helping me is just like adjusting your own pillow. It's just one life. What does the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion do with so many hands and eyes? It's like someone reaching back for the pillow at night. I understand. Thawa said, how do you understand? See, because in words are, as soon as you speak, you create a distance between yourself and the world and everybody else. So when he says, I understand, that's language, right? He says, well, but how do you experience it? So how do you experience it? All over the body is hands and eyes. My whole body is hands and eyes. So you said a lot there, but you only got 80%. What do you say? Throughout the body is hands and eyes. When you sit on the cushion, people usually come to the cushion. They come to Chan or they come to Zen because they are troubled by the sense of separation from the world and from other people. And when you sit on the cushion, you gradually realize that the boundaries of yourself do not stop with your physical body. Although the physical body is real and is part of your yourself. Really, the boundary, yourself, your awareness, has no boundaries. As we practice Zen, this becomes more and more obvious. We just keep experiencing the dissipation, the dissolving of these boundaries, and to keep experiencing more and more this this greater connectedness, which you can call true self, if you want. Greater sense of connectedness. This is what Chan is all about. And you can go on and on forever. It's just the most wonderful thing in the world. So no telepathy, but something better, right? One body. It's one body. One great body. All of it is ours. So, thank you for coming today. Page 20, please. Four great vows. This is Wei Nang's four great vows in Japanese pronunciation. Shujo muhen segando.
Om Namo Buddhaya Sekanda Buddha Sudha.